a backup audio, because sometimes this doesn't work. All right. So for benefits of the recording, which I would have gotten left off the recording, and for new people who are just walking in, there's two seats up here in the very front, and one seat here in the middle, two seats here in the middle. Right, so sorry for the repetition. I'm Kevin Skadron. I'm teaching one of the two sections in 3130. Already covered this material and briefly mentioned some of the themes that we're going to be going over. So automating building software. Here's a simple example. Let's say my application foo, on a Linux system, it actually wouldn't have the .exe ending, but let's say I make some edit in one line of this readline.c. What I want to be able to do is type the command make, and we'll learn about that shortly, and have it run just the necessary build steps to update that application. So what we see here is that's going to result in compiling this particular step that depends on readline.c, which is what I changed here. And that's going to produce this object file that's based on that .c file. And then I'm going to include that in a library called libreadline.a that has a couple of component packages, including readline. And then we build the final executable here, foo.exe, in this line that incorporates that library, readline, that was affected by my change to that .c file. And we'll look at all this syntax in more detail. This is like just a sweeping sampling to give you a flavor of some topics that we're going to be touching on in the course. And what you notice here is that this library, libreadline.a, in this line here, is not, it depends on terminal.o, but in the lines above that, we're not recompiling terminal.o. We're just picking up the existing object file. We don't have to recompile that if it's not affected by my edit to readline.c. And there's also a foo.o and a foo-utility.o that are incorporated into this executable foo.exe. And those are not being recompiled either, because they don't need to be. And make, as we'll see either at the end of this lecture or in the next lecture, lets you do that in a very easy way. It's a super useful tool. It's really goes well beyond just facility and computer systems. This is one of the basic tools that you need if you're writing software. We'll also spend some time talking about how different applications share machines. And so, supposing, for example, that I have a process A that is going to coexist here on the actual machine with some process B that's also running. And pieces of process A and process B both are in the system memory. They might also be running at the same time on the CPU. How do we achieve that without having them step on each other? Well, we do that by using a concept called virtual addressing. So every application that runs on any modern system, except maybe some super, super tiny basic embedded systems that can't support this feature, every modern architecture supports virtual memory. And the idea is that every application has this virtual view that it has the machine all to itself, it has the whole memory space to itself, and it doesn't need to worry about other applications unless it's explicitly trying to communicate with them and permission is set up for them to communicate. We'll look at how to do that too. But in this virtual addressing idea, process A can refer to any address 0 to whatever the maximum possible address is. And those virtual addresses will get mapped by the operating system to the appropriate location, which might be here, in physical memory. So there's a mechanism in the system, and it's actually a combination of software and hardware that translates these virtual addresses into the actual locations in physical memory. And the translations for process A only exist for pieces of memory that process A is actually using. When process A is running, there will be literally no physical way that it can refer to memory owned by process B, unless this process B explicitly shares that memory with A. And so this is a basic protection mechanism so that processes can't snoop on each other's data, and also so that they don't accidentally overwrite each other's data. And this is happening for every address that's accessed. So every time the processor fetches an assembly instruction, it's actually specifying an address in memory to read that instruction from. That's the program counter. And we read that instruction from memory. We refer to that using a virtual address. So the program counter is using virtual addresses. We fetch that instruction. That instruction might be a load or a store that is going to read or write to memory. And that data access will also be a virtual address. And I'll also note that the virtual address space that an application can refer to doesn't have to be the same size as the physical memory, right? We want you to be able to have machines that could have different amounts of physical memory, 4 gigabytes, 8 gigabytes, maybe a terabyte for a server. But most modern hardware and operating systems support 64-bit virtual address spaces. So the virtual address space is 64-bit, which means we have 2 to the 64 possible byte locations in memory. That's a big address space. That allows us to really treat as memory a very large amount of data. A typical physical memory is gigabytes to terabytes. So that's 2 to the 30 or 2 to the 40 byte addresses. So that means that a bunch of different applications might actually oversubscribe the physical memory, and we have a way to deal with that too. So virtual memory also allows spilling or paging data to disk. And so we can pretend that the disk is like an extension of main memory. Now, that's obviously going to be very slow, right? You wouldn't want to normally be actively accessing data that's sitting on disk. So every time we touch data that is not currently in memory, that has been pushed out to disk, we bring it into the memory and push something else out to make room for it. And that's called swapping. And to manage all this, as I mentioned, we need a combination of software that's handled, that part is the operating system, and hardware. So the software part of this is maintaining a table of those mappings at some granularity. And it's not going to be at every byte, because that would be a humongous table that would already fill up all our memory. So it's going to be in larger chunks that we call pages. And We don't want to have to run software for every single assembly instruction we're running to figure out what that translation is. That would mean we would have to spend multiple clock cycles for every instruction. So we have something called a translation look-aside buffer, which is a small hardware structure on the chip that keeps the most recently used translations and allows them to be translated on the fly with essentially no time overhead. Okay, so in reality, your computer is going to be running multiple applications simultaneously. If you look at the set of processes that are running, you'll see many processes there. And the operating system, as each process requests memory, finds an open spot here in the physical memory that it can place this new allocation into, and then sets up the corresponding mappings, both in that software page table and in the translation look-aside buffer. And so that way you ensure that you have space for everything. You also need space for some operating system code and data. And if you try to access a virtual address that doesn't have a mapping because that has been swapped to disk, the operating system will get invoked through something called an exception and will bring that data in from disk. Or if you access a virtual address that doesn't have a mapping because that virtual address wasn't allocated yet, we'll take an exception. And when we look in the page table and find that that virtual address was never allocated, you'll get a fault. Has anybody ever experienced a seg fault? That's what that is. You accessed some memory that wasn't allocated. The operating system can, in a modern multi-core machine, can actually be running several different processes at once. But and even with hyper-threading, a single core can run two different applications at once. But if we sort of simplify the picture a little bit, at any point in time, the operating system is having one or maybe a couple applications or threads running on a given processor core. And it's choosing periodically which one gets to run. And so that's called a context switch when it changes from A to B. So continuing with the theme of sharing and also concurrency, we want to make maximum use of the CPU cores. And so let's say I have an application readinput.exe, and it's running along here in blue, and now it tries to do some I/O, and it wants to read from disk. So that read is an operating system call that invokes the operating system to access the protected resource of the disk. And so the gray here is meant to show the operating system. And what the operating system do is going to set up the I/O access. Disk is very slow, so this is going to take milliseconds compared to your CPU's nanosecond clock, actually probably less than a nanosecond. So you don't want the CPU to just sit around waiting for milliseconds, so thousands or tens of thousands of clock cycles doing nothing. So the OS is going to do a context switch and run some other application. So what it's going to do here is it's going to invoke some other application. So maybe this would be SSH, and then SSH wants to do some I/O. So now we can switch to Firefox, and perhaps Firefox wants to do some I/O. But in the meantime, the read input disk request has come back, and read input can run again. And so we might allow read input to to go. And actually, I forgot here in this example, it wasn't reading from disk, it was reading from the keyboard. And actually, humans are even slower than disks. The idea here being that whenever an application has some I/O to do, or something else that would take time when the CPU would be idle, the operating system is going to do a context switch to do other work if there's any other useful work to do. Now, if there's literally nothing else for the CPU to do because there are no other applications that want to run, then the CPU will go into a low power mode until either an application is ready to run or something happens in the system, like that keyboard input or disk I/O request completing, that means that you want to run a new application or resume an existing application that was waiting. We also want to make sure that an application can't hog the CPU. So suppose you have a loop. Suppose you've written an application with an infinite loop. You don't want it to tie up the CPU forever and not let other applications run. You want to interrupt it so that some other application can run periodically. So an infinite loop would be the ultimate example of what we call a CPU-bound application. It's just running instructions on the CPU, not really doing any useful work, but that's not the main point here. And so what we need to be able to do is preemptive scheduling. So we context switch if the time slice expires. So a typical time slice might be on the order of a millisecond. So your infinite loop is running, after a millisecond expires, it gets interrupted and suspended, and we context switch to something else. Some other applications run, eventually it's this loop application's time to run again. And so it'll get another time slice, and so on and so forth. This avoids hogging the CPU, and it provides the illusion of interactivity even when some applications are compute intensive. So let's imagine we have loop.exe running together with our readInput.exe that's reading from your input from the keyboard. You wouldn't want an infinite loop that's also running on the system to tie it up so that your interactive application doesn't actually get the chance to interact with you or seems really sluggish. And so the time slice is set to be small enough that you can't really tell that there's other stuff going on. Right? So if you enter some input, read input will do its next chunk of work and immediately come back with another prompt for you to enter some more input. Even though in the meantime, loop.exe and maybe some other applications got some time slices. Because you can't really tell when there's a delay that's less than on the order of a 30th of a second, right? You can do a lot of work on other applications in a 30th of a second. Another example of where we want the system to get involved is when we have some kind of delay. So same picture here, but a different reason for the delay. Instead of getting interrupted, let's say what we do is we have some loop stuff, and it's not an infinite loop anymore. This is compute intensive. And then this application calls, then this application has a delay, right? It goes to sleep or has some other source of delay, like waiting for input. We want the operating system to suspend it and do other work here. So In reality, modern systems have multiple cores, and many applications have multiple threads. So multiple cores let you do multiple things at once. Those might be different applications or different threads, but what are these threads that I keep talking about? So threads are, you can think of as being different tasks in the same process or program. By the way, the terminology in computer systems that we prefer to use is a program is the executable that's sitting on disk. That's the software that you wrote. The process is a dynamic execution of a program. And so you could have many different processes running the same program. Many different people could be running Firefox on the same machine. Within a process, multiple threads might do different tasks. Like in this example, you might have one thread that's handling the graphics rendering for Firefox and another thread that's handling the network requests for Firefox. And if you have multiple cores, you probably want to spread those threads across different cores. The threads, for the most part, Firefox kind of actually does something more sophisticated, but the typical view is that threads share the same address space. So they can access shared global data within the same process, right? You'd want all the different parts of Firefox to be able to access global data that's relevant to that particular process. But if you have two different Firefox processes that were launched separately, maybe by different users, of course they shouldn't be sharing data. And each of these cores is getting context switched as the execution pattern requires. So let's say that the Firefox graphics rendering finishes and there's no more work for Firefox to do, the OS might switch to run a different application, like SSH, on that first core. And let's say core 2 was running a compile job, and the compiler gets to a point where it needs to read some stuff from disk, so it gets suspended. Now we can run another Firefox thread, and that Firefox thread might now make a network request and have to wait for a network response. So in the meantime, if the file has been read from disk into memory, Clang can resume. I'm getting a little ahead of my slides here, but so we've covered some different ways that different applications might share machines. There's another aspect of sharing that we need to talk about, which is how do we protect access to resources, not just memory for running applications, but other kinds of protection, like protecting access to files on disk. So if we share execution on a machine, maybe not your laptop, although you might share that laptop with somebody and have different accounts, but think more along the lines of different users sharing a server, like in our department servers, I shouldn't be able to read your files and vice versa. And so if you try to access my secret file, we want you to get an error message unless I've explicitly made that file readable. So you should get something like this. You as a regular user also shouldn't be able to shut down the system. So access to certain operating system functionalities and operating system utilities is restricted. Shutdown being just a simple example. We'll also look under the hood of some of the basic aspects of networking. Longer treatment would be in the networking course. But just briefly, we'll look at the different layers of the network stack, which go from the physical layer, which is where we're actually encoding bits to send on the communication medium, whether that's Wi-Fi or Ethernet, up to the link layer, which is the actual sort of management of different users trying to access the shared medium. So if you have different applications or different nodes on the network that are trying to access this shared Ethernet wired link or the shared airspace for Wi-Fi, you need to manage things like collisions so that different applications or different endpoints on the network don't corrupt each other's data. We need a way to specify how you reach specific machines. How do you know that the network packets you're sending are going to the machine you want and not to some middleman who's trying to steal your data? And that's called the network layer. And that's managed with things like network addresses and domain name servers. Then we have the transport layer, which ensures that the packets you're sending are actually reaching their intended destination successfully, so reliable transport. And it also deals with congestion control deals with things like applications that are trying to send huge reams of data interleaved with applications that are trying to send network packets or receive network packets in real time for something like a voice, like FaceTime or video streaming. And then the application layer, which actually interprets the data that are in those packets. So if we go from the bottom to the top again in the stack, the physical layer is actually encoding the bits in terms of whatever the desired medium is. So for Ethernet on the wire, that's actually controlling the voltages that indicate whether we're sending ones and zeros. For Wi-Fi, it's the pulses that we send out over the radio. The link layer, as I mentioned, is coordinating the sharing and ensuring that we don't have two different endpoints that are talking over each other and corrupting each other's data. And a common way to deal with that actually is to detect that there's contention, that two endpoints are talking over each other, and then tell one to back off. For the network layer, we have packets that have addresses that say where they're going, and we have a mechanism to determine what the correct address is for our destination. The transport layer, TCP is the most common network transport layer, and it determines how packets get acknowledged to indicate that they were received, and deals with things like packets that arrive out of order, either because they follow a different path through the network, or one got corrupted and needed to be resent, and allows them to be reassembled. And then, as I mentioned, the application layer is at what's actually using the data in those packets. So to make all this work, we need logical identifiers that indicate these different aspects. So we can actually extend this concept of a logical identifier all the way down to software, right? So in the programs you write, a logical identifier would be a variable, like a variable counter, that indicates a specific location in memory where that value is stored. For naming a network endpoint, we use DNS to look up what the IP address is. And there are two main standards, IPv4, which was an older standard, and it's actually running out of namespace. So the networked world is gradually moving to IPv6, which has longer strings so that you have a larger namespace for more network devices. On Ethernet, we also indicate an endpoint through a different kind of hardware address called a MAC address. And if you look in your system, you can actually find out what the MAC address is, for example, for your Wi-Fi. And then we have service names like HTTPS, which will are referring to a so-called network port, which is what you need to open a socket to that service. So then there's the question of secure communication. So We do this with something called sockets. That's an abstraction. Let me write this out. Is a connection to another network endpoint and a port at that endpoint. And a port you can think of as roughly being analogous to some service. You can write your own software that's going to listen on the network to provide some custom service that you're building and get allocated a specific port number for that custom service. These ports are not limited to sort of existing standard services. And so later in the course, when we get to networking, we'll look at how you can be sure that the DNS is actually giving you the address, the IP address of the real service that you're trying to access with the real host that you want. Like, you're actually talking to Google, not some imposter. And how we'll ensure that only the process that has opened the socket can access data from that socket, even though many processes may be sharing the machine and sharing that network interface. We'll also look, as I mentioned, under the hood of processors and what makes them fast and what some of the performance implications are that you might need to be aware of. So here's a picture of an old single-core CPU. And we chose an old single-core CPU so that it's easier just to show on the screen. A modern multi-core CPU has shrunk this down to one tiny tile on the die and basically has many copies of this to give you many cores. And then there will be another region of a giant shared cache that all the cores share. But in the single-core world, the core actually breaks down into a bunch of specific hardware units. So the fetch unit here is what uses the program counter to fetch an instruction and decode it and then figure out what to do next. And it's fetching it from the instruction cache, which is a very small, fast, level one cache that can give you the value you're trying to read, in this case an instruction, in typically one clock cycle. And if that instruction is an add, it would use the execution units and perform the add, and the operands for that add, the two add ends, would come from a register file, which you can kind of see on here is probably that unit right there. Now, if you're doing a load or store, you're going to access data from memory, but hopefully you'll find the values you want in the L1 data cache and be able to get those values within one or two clock cycles and put them in registers that maybe a subsequent add instruction is going to use. And the load store unit is here. By the way, there's no rhyme or reason to my colors here. I'm just trying to use different colors. The load store unit is what coordinates access to the memory. And there are certain ordering properties that have to be enforced in memory access, especially if you do have a multi-core or multi-socket machine where different threads might, on different cores or sockets, might be trying to access the same cache line. There's a property we have to enforce called coherence. By the way, when I say socket, a modern motherboard might have room for more than one CPU chip. Today, that would be a multi-core chip, but still, you might have two different physical sockets that you can plug a CPU chip into. And so high-end servers are often multi-socket. And then if your arithmetic uses floating point, then you have dedicated hardware for that. The arithmetic there is a little bit different. Now, So we've looked at where the registers are. Floating point units often have their own registers, by the way. We've looked at where the L1 caches are. These 2004 chips also had a larger L2 cache. So you really want to try to avoid going out to memory. It's very expensive. So the way we do that is to have the largest cache we can fit on the chip. But the larger caches are slower. So an L2 cache access time might be on the order of 10 cycles. We don't want to have to wait 10 cycles every time we do a load or a store. So the L1 cache has the most frequently, most recently accessed values, and we can access the L1 cache much faster. And the register file is at the top of this hierarchy. You can access it effectively instantaneously. So as the instruction is flowing along through the processing pipeline, it, within a single clock cycle, it can read the values, and in the next clock cycle, you can do the add, and then in the next clock cycle, you write that value back to the registers. Also, registers can be named in the actual assembly instruction. You probably did this in 2130, where you wrote assembly, whereas the cache is being accessed with regular memory addresses. And somewhere here in the load store unit, by the way, I don't know where it is, but somewhere in here will be that TLB that I mentioned. The cache is the virtual to physical address mappings. More recent systems have what's called an L3 cache, or maybe even an L4 cache that's even larger, to provide more capacity. And the L3 or L4 cache are shared across different cores. And that latency might be on the order of 20 to 30 clock cycles. And then we go out to main memory. And if you think about all of your storage as part of a hierarchy, you could also think of your actual disk storage as being part of this hierarchy, where the latency is on the order of milliseconds. So an example of how the architecture of the CPU affects performance in maybe a non-obvious way. If I write this code here that is a loop that's running ten billion times, and it's doing this little sequence of arithmetic operations here and then looping back to the top of the loop. So this here is the loop condition that brings you back up to the top of the loop. This here is just setting the loop boundary. If I run that whole program and do that loop 10 billion times, it's going to be about 30 billion instructions. And that'll take on a modern CPU about 2.65 seconds. What if I put another add in here? Now my code takes 40 billion instructions. That's a 33% increase in the number of instructions that need to be executed for my program to complete. It still takes 2.65 seconds. Why? Because modern CPUs have the ability to execute two arithmetic instructions that are independent of each other simultaneously. So that extra add just fits into this execution slot with no overhead. And you can see that they're independent because the registers here are different from each other. So there's no dependency, there's no reason they can't run in parallel. This is another form of concurrency that you don't worry about as a programmer. This is happening under the hood. But it can explain some curious performance characteristics, like the fact that a 33% increase in my instruction count has no impact on performance. So another topic of this course is making you more proficient in C. Now, maybe before I get to the C topic, let me just stop and ask if people have any questions. All right, so why C? C is still a common language in many application settings, but especially in programming at the lower systems level. So if you're writing backend code for servers, or if you're writing applications for embedded systems, in many cases, you'll be writing in C. It remains, I happened to just see this in the news the other day, one of the top 10 most important job skills for employers. So it's just a really useful language to have in your toolbox. C is tricky though, because we can do stuff with arrays and pointers that can easily trip you up. It doesn't provide some of the same safety features and abstractions that higher level languages do. On the other hand, C is a small, well-contained language. You can look at a piece of C code and almost mentally map it to assembly language, which isn't even true for C++, let alone higher level languages. So let's actually do this exercise. We've got this code here that defines an array, and we do a little bit of pointer and array manipulation. And I want you to talk to one or two of your neighbors and tell me what the contents of array will be at the end of that code sequence. A, B, C, D, E, or F. So take a couple minutes and talk to your neighbors and see what you think. And then we'll take a vote. Do people need another minute, or are we ready to vote? Everybody ready to vote? All right, how many people think the answer's A? Okay, how many people think it's B? All right, a lot of votes for B. How many people think it's C? C is not popular. D, anybody for D? Okay, how about E? All right, a few votes for E. What about F? Okay. So the actual answer is B. So the majority was right here. So let's talk about why. So to do that, we need to walk through what's happening here. So P is a variable that is going to store a pointer. And here we initialize it to the address that is the beginning of the array, right? It's the address of array element 0. Now, we're going to do P plus equals 2. So pointer arithmetic operates in chunks of the object size it was declared as. So if I do P plus 1, P plus plus, I'm actually moving the address by an amount equal to the size of an int. So on a modern system, that would be 4 or 8 bytes. So in other words, I'm actually moving it to the P plus plus, would be moving it to the second element here. But I do P plus equals 2, so P now points to array element 2. All right? Now, I can use this pointer as if it's an array. So I can refer to P array index 1. And remember, arrays start at 0. So P array index 1 is like P plus 1 in int-sized steps. So P of, let me draw this a little bit differently. This is P of 1. Yes, this is P of 1. And I just didn't quite draw it. I should have drawn it pointing to the 40, not like at the end of the array. So P is still pointing to the 30 here, to that location in the array. So if I said P of 0, I would be pointing to the 30, but P of 1 is pointing to the next element. And now I'm adding 1 to the value. So 40 is going to become 41. So in C, you can play these games with pointers and arrays and treat a pointer to an array as an actual array. So what I did here is I had the pointer point in the middle of the array. It's an array of ints. The pointer is an int star. And so now I can treat P as a new array. P, my P array, starts where the blue arrow is pointing, the 30. So any questions about this? People comfortable with this notation? So hopefully you've seen this before, and this is a just kind of like a reminder. Yeah, question.
So when you add 2 to P, is there a way to access 10 or 20 with the indexing notation? Like, could you use a negative index, or is that not?
Oh, geez. I actually don't know for sure. I have never tried that, and I would recommend not doing that.
So you said it operates in chunks of the size that it was declared to be. What happens if the array is not stored in like sequential memory? So like if the array is stored in different places of memory, or does that never happen?
So in C, that won't happen.
That won't happen. Okay.
So an array will be a contiguous stream of bytes in sort of chunks of whatever your object size is. So an int array will be...
It will always be that.
Yeah. So I am embarrassed to admit, I don't know. That's a bit of an arcane question. It's a fair question, but you shouldn't do it. Let me just check my notes here and make sure I didn't miss anything. Okay, so let's move on to another C exercise. This one's much more hairy. So let's take a little bit of time to discuss this. and we'll vote again. So, just in the interest of time, I'm going to have to interrupt this lively discussion. I suspect the answers here will be a little more divergent, but I want to get through some course logistics material at the end, so apologies for rushing you a bit. How many people think it's A? Okay, a few brave souls. How many people think it's B? C, D, E, F. All right, no clear majority here. The answer is A, if you assume that the compiler is doing strict type checking. So there's actually a type mismatch right here, and we'll get to that in a minute. But let's just walk through what's happening here. All right, so I drew a couple of things here to help us visualize what's happening. So we've declared array one, and that's stored somewhere in memory in the data segment of the process. We've declared array two, but haven't defined its contents. Memory is set aside for it, which I showed in blue, but there aren't any values there yet, or there are garbage values that aren't initialized. Note that array 1 is an array of ints, and array 2 is an array of int pointers. Now we have this mystery function that takes an argument, and note here that that argument is passed by value, not by reference, right? So we'll get a copy here. And we're going to do some fiddling around with addresses when we call it. Now the main function is going to declare a pointer, an int pointer, which is a pointer to an int pointer. And now we're going to say that q is equal to array 2. Now that is valid because array 2, it's an array of int pointers. And so array 2 itself, remember the little trick we played in the last example, the name array 2 is actually an int star star. So if we say array 2 of, let's say, 1, now we get a particular element in this array that is an int star. But the name of an array always adds an extra level of pointer to it. So array 2 is an int star star. And so it's valid for q to point to array 2. Now, it's a pointer. Now, we're going to pass the value of q to mystery. And so p will be initialized to also point here. And now we're going to take p and we're going to dereference it. So the value of p will be set to equal, we're going to change what it points to. It's going to point to the address of array 1, value 2. Whoops. All right. Now, when we leave this mystery function, p is pointing to array 1, element 2. Sorry, p has, I made a mistake here, nobody caught it. P has the, I want to use a different color for this. It's not the value. I want to make clear here. It is what I've put here is the address of that element in the array. Right? So P is a pointer to an element in this array. Now I want to go into array 1, element 1 here, and I'm trying to set it to equal the value of q. So this is where the compiler error arises, because I'm trying to set, this is type int, and this is type int star. So when I do star q, when I use it as a value and I put a star in front of it, I'm dereferencing a pointer. So I'm dereferencing an int star star and turning it into an int star. But I'm trying to assign it to an int. And if my compiler is doing strict type checking, which I always encourage you to do, it will fail and say this is an error. Now, you could turn off strict type checking, it'll still warn you, but compile, and then you'll probably get garbage. Or if you really, really wanted to do this for some reason, you could have put a cast here and said that you want to cast this int star into an int. So a cast is kind of a way of saying, yes, I really want to change the type of this. I'm not doing it accidentally. So we'll talk more about these things later, but I want to save the last 10 minutes for some logistics. So just maybe one or two quick questions about this. So pointer manipulation can be tricky. Multi-layer pointers can be trickier still. When you play around with pointers and arrays and sort of intermingle the notation, it can get a little mind-bending. You know, I've been in the career a while. I still have to stop when I see one of these things and think very, very carefully about what's going on. It's a trick that we play when writing C for convenience, But you also have to be very, very careful about whether it's readable. And if there's a more straightforward way to write your C code to avoid some of this hairy stuff, just do that. If you really have to play games like this, write comments so that some poor soul who's reading your code a year later or 10 years later can figure out what your thought process was, right? If I look at this code, Charles actually came up with this example. If I look at this code for the first time, I'm like, oh my God, what is going on here? And it takes time to walk through it, right? A comment would have made this much more clear. Okay, so changing gears here and talking about logistics. So coming into this course, we're assuming that you've had CS01 or an equivalent course. And in particular, to make sure that you're up to date, you should feel comfortable, especially with labs 9 through 12 from a prior offering of CS01, that should say last spring. And here's a link to a prior offering of the course. And some exercises that you should be comfortable with are things like the string sep library function, conversions from a dynamic array to a straight to a linked list. These kinds of C manipulation are things that you should be familiar with. We'll do a little bit of C refresher, but being fluent in C is going to be important in this class, as well as I mentioned, it's valuable for your career. So I'm going to skip over this pointer stuff. It'll be in the slides if you want to review it. This semester, we're going to have two different sections. My section, obviously this one, Professor Rice's, is immediately afterwards over on the other side of grounds. We'll have the same labs, homeworks, probably the same quizzes. That might change a little bit if our sections diverge. I'll be lecturing the 12:30 slot most of the time. Professor Rice will be lecturing in the 2 o'clock slot, but there'll be a few days when one or the other of us are out of town and we'll cover both, or for some reason we might need to swap. Labs will be an important part of this course. You'll have a lab every week. And in the lab, you'll do some work to gain familiarity with the concepts we're talking about. And you'll have the lab TAs there to help you if you have questions. I strongly encourage you to attend the lab in person and get checked off by the TA. But you do have the option, if you really don't or can't attend the lab that day, to just submit the work to our online submission system and get credit for it. The advantage of going to the lab is you can work with your colleagues, you can partner with them to get the work done, you can get help from the TAs, and the TAs will give you feedback, right? So when you go to get checked off, if they spot an issue, they might say, go fix this issue, and then come back. If you just submit it, you may get those points marked off. There'll be a few labs that absolutely require attendance. If there's an issue that particular week that you can't attend, let us know. And of course, if something happens like you're sick or an interview that you just couldn't avoid scheduling at another time, let us know. So like I said, please collaborate on labs. When you are collaborating on labs, make sure that anything you submit clearly indicates who you collaborated with. Whether you are doing this in person or submitting online. So you had to sign up for a lab section. And the labs are mostly full, except for the 6:30 slot, and the labs are constrained by space. So you can attend another lab if there's space, but certainly in the first number of weeks, I expect that the labs will be pretty full. And we're going to need to give priority to the people who actually signed up for that time slot. The labs will build skills that you'll then use in the programming assignments, the homeworks. And we'll have several of these that you do individually, not with partners. No sharing code on the homeworks. The labs are Wednesday. The homeworks will generally be due the following Friday. And you can see the dates on the schedule and how the labs feed the homeworks. Again, collaboration policy is online in the website policy section, but you have to do the homeworks individually, and no sharing code, no taking code from online, etc. Some of the labs and homeworks have automatic testing. So you can submit to the submission site, get feedback, find out which criteria in the rubric you missed, fix those, and resubmit. And we'll take the latest submission before the deadline. Testing framework has some delay, so don't debug by iterative submission, right? Debug using proper debugging, GDB, things like that. Submit when you're pretty confident that it's right, because that delay will prevent you from just sort of quickly submitting and finding out what's wrong. There will be times when the testing program thinks it's wrong when you're sure it's right. And that's just unavoidable. So when the grading infrastructure fails, we will look at things manually to figure out what's going on. And the intention here is not that we're testing for some secret conditions. If your code passes the tests, there shouldn't be any surprises afterwards. And after you get the grading back, if you think the testing program is making a mistake, there's a mechanism for you to submit a regrade request on that grading system. Whoops, I forgot to update the date here. This is, I think, September 13th. You can check the schedule. Your first warm-up C assignment will be to take a string as an argument and split it into an array of strings using dynamic memory allocation. So malloc and free are other common sources of bugs in C programs. Yes, question.
So labs are on Wednesday. Are they due the same day?
They're due Thursday at noon.
The next day?
Yes. So if you can't attend the lab and you just want to submit it online, you have a little bit of extra time to submit it. And you'll also write a make file for this. So we're going to have quizzes each week. They'll generally be released the evening after the Thursday lecture, starting next week, and they'll be due 15 minutes before the Tuesday lecture. So you'll have Friday, the weekend, and Monday, and Tuesday morning to work on them. And they'll be about concepts from that week's lectures or the lab. They're meant to be short, 5 to 6 questions. They're meant to be done individually, but they're open book, open note, open internet, right? We want you to learn the material. And each question will have a space where you can enter a comment if you don't understand the question or you think there's a bug in the question, and answer options where you can explain what you did. Please use that so we can give partial credit. And if you think there's something unclear about the quiz question, make your best guess about what it was trying to do and what the most likely answer is, and then just put an explanation. TAs and Professor Rice and I won't answer questions specifically about the quiz, but we will answer questions about the corresponding material if you want to clarify something to help you answer the quiz question correctly. So if you had a quiz question about pointer stuff and you were unclear on something about pointer semantics, we're happy to help you with those kind of questions. And then whether we go over quizzes in class or not will depend on whether most people were comfortable with the answers or whether there seemed to be a conceptual gap. We don't have a textbook for this course. All the readings are on the website. And I already covered this. There's only one exam. It'll be a final exam in person on the assigned date. So see the official exam schedule for when that's going to be. The time of the exam may be different for the two different sections. And so Professor Rice and I, we have a common exam slot. By the way, I didn't introduce Professor Rice. He's here in the back. And I think that's actually noted on the official exam schedule as one of the specific courses. Okay, I don't think I need to go over the rest of this except for this one last slide, getting help. So we'll have a lot of office hours that we'll post. We'll have a Piazza site, and you can certainly feel free to email us if you have questions. Thanks, everyone.